Luke chapter 6 is where we pick things up tonight. Now it happened on the second Sabbath, and the key word here is Sabbath because it sets the tone for the event. Jesus came into this world and he honored and fulfilled the Old Testament law to a T. But he did not allow himself to be encumbered in any way, not for 5 minutes, by the traditions of men and the wrong interpretations of God's law that had been come up with by the religious leaders of his day. He just went on about his business. He knew what the law said. He knew what God meant by the law. And of course, because what God meant by the law and what the religious leaders of Jesus' day thought that God meant by the law were two entirely different things, he was continually getting into hot water as it relates to the religious leaders. So it's a Sabbath day. The Sabbath day after the first, that he went through the grain fields and his disciples plucked the heads of grain, that's harvesting, and they ate them, rubbing them in their hands. And some of the Pharisees said to them, "Why are you doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath?" Now God had said in his law that you were not allowed to labor on the Sabbath day in that I wasn't free to go and harvest my field on the Sabbath day. I wasn't free to work. There were 6 days for that. The Sabbath day was a day of rest. And the poor had the right of going into a field and taking what was necessary for their sustenance as the poor. They just couldn't take a sickle into the field and harvest for themselves. And so here the disciples and Jesus are doing what is lawful within God's intent concerning the law, but it violated the interpretations of the religious leaders concerning the law, who were saying that to even take a bit of wheat within your hand, to pluck it would be to harvest, to rub the grain in your hand and separate the chaff from the wheat, that constituted the winnowing and the threshing, and then to allow the chaff to fall to the ground and then to eat the wheat, that constituted winnowing. It was labor. And that was their interpretation of the law. And so they come and they say, "Why are you doing what's not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" And Jesus answered them, and he said, "Have you not even read this?" And again, as we've seen in the other Gospels, this would have been an offense to them. He doesn't purposely offend, but it was a method of teaching in those days where someone would say, "Well, you're confronting me on this particular issue, but have you never read concerning this in the Scriptures?" In order that it would fill out their interpretation of the Scriptures because they were seeing it more narrow than they ought to, and as a result, they were misinterpreting the Scriptures. And so Jesus speaks to these men to whom nobody spoke this way, nobody corrected these men, and those are men and women that need correction the most, because nobody speaks to them. So Jesus said to them, "Have you never read this? What David did when he was hungry," and he quotes now an event concerning King David in the Old Testament, "and he and those who were with him, how he went into the house of God, he took and ate the showbread and also gave some to those who were with him, which is not lawful for any but the priests to eat." So he asked them this question, and I'm convinced there's a pause between verses 4 and 5. They have no answer as it relates to this. And what Jesus is doing here as he cites David from the Old Testament is they're criticizing Jesus and his disciples, considering this picking of grain on the Sabbath day to be a violation of the law. Jesus cites this passage from the Old Testament to reveal to them that it wasn't necessary to interpret the law so strictly. Matthew's Gospel declares a little more fully concerning this incident that Jesus went on to say to these religious leaders, "But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless," that is the disciples. And what he's saying to them is, you're interpreting the scriptures on the basis of sacrifice. All your interpretations lean toward excessive harshness. And he said, what you need to do in order to properly interpret God's law is to lean toward mercy. Then you'll be closer to his heart. And as he cites this incident concerning David, and David in the Old Testament clearly violated the law, and so did the priest in giving those loaves. Those loaves were only for the priests. And why did the religious leaders not have a problem with David receiving those loaves in that particular instance? Because they were selective in how they interpreted the scriptures and how they applied it. They were merciful toward those that they wanted to be merciful toward. That is, the great King David. But who they wanted to use the scriptures to hammer, it was all sacrifice in terms of their interpretation. And Jesus confronts them with their selectiveness on this and their lack of mercy and interpretation. And there's some of us who are born with a tendency to look at the scriptures in the realm of sacrifice. We always look for the harshest kind of interpretation related to it, and we have to learn, as Christ works in our life, to factor mercy into the situation. Then there are others, it's all mercy. They know nothing of sacrifice. They know nothing of strictness related to things. They need to learn to bring a little bit of sacrifice into it. But that wasn't the problem of these religious leaders. I've known people over the years where when they read the scriptures, all they see are the exhortive texts. They see nothing of God's mercy. They see nothing of God's grace in the passages. All they see is just they go from one exhortive text to the next, to the next, to the next. They love the exhortive text. And sometimes I've said to them, listen, I want you to read the Bible, but the next time you read through the Bible, I want you to notice every encouragement in the passage. And then there are others that I say, listen, I want you to read the Bible, and I want you to read every exhortive passage that you come to. But there is that tendency on our parts to go sometimes to one extreme or another. And so they had no answer to this. Jesus had confronted them. And so he said to them, the Son of Man is also Lord of the harvest, Lord of the Sabbath. In other words, gentlemen, I am, as God, free to do exactly what I want on the Sabbath day. End of discussion. He is the Lord of the Sabbath. And so it happened on another Sabbath, and there's the key word again, Sabbath, also that he entered the synagogue and he taught. And there was a man there whose right hand was withered. Now, Luke here is the physician, and he makes note of which hand is withered. He's a doctor, so he takes note of these things. And I remember we had a friend when we were living in Napa before we moved over here, and she had been playing volleyball, and she fell backwards, put her wrists down, and she broke both of her wrists. They took her to the hospital, and they're wheeling her in for surgery. And they started to work around her chest. They were prepping her for open-heart surgery. Oh, it's funny now. She said something in effect of, excuse me, what are we doing here? I have two broken wrists. I don't need a new heart tonight. And, but you know, this kind of stuff goes on, you know, where they like do the surgery on the wrong eye or some kind of a deal like that. And you want a doctor who notices this kind of stuff. I like Luke. It was the right hand. So he's got this withered right hand, just like this. It's good for nothing. It's just like a tree thing that's just withered away. It just sits like this. And he's in the synagogue. The religious leaders have had all the months and years that they could ever want to make a difference in this man's life. They'd made no difference in his life. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched Jesus closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. The whole thing is a setup. They have no concern for this man with a withered hand. I mean, the proper reaction would be, all right, Jesus came into the synagogue. That guy with that bum right hand is finally going to get healed. Because they knew, and it's an interesting thing as we've seen before, is they trapped Jesus on the basis of something that they know about him. And what they knew about Jesus is that when he walked in a room, his eye went immediately to the person with the greatest need. And so it did in this instance. He walked in and the man with the greatest need was the man with the withered hand. Jesus fixes his eyes on this man. Now they're going to see whether he's going to heal him on the Sabbath day. And in healing on the Sabbath day, if he healed on the Sabbath day, it would not be a violation of God's law, but it would violate their interpretation of the law, which was entirely different from what God intended by the law. When we were in Israel on this last trip, we had a guide by the name of Mickey, and he was a young guy, Russian Jew, and he knew the Lord, and it was a blessing to have a guide that was a believer. And it's a blessing to have a young guy. You know, people get older and they don't say so much. So we had him in this guide, and he would say a lot, and he would talk about the culture, and he would talk about what it was to be a Jew, and he would talk about the interpretations that the rabbis of his day or historically had applied to the scriptures. And you'd listen to him quote this passage or some passage and then say what the rabbi in some point in history had said concerning the passage, and then that interpretation had been glommed onto and held all the way to the present day. And you listen to what he was saying and you say, wait a second, that passage has nothing to do with that. But the traditions, the interpretations, they just kind of got etched into history and nobody questioned them anymore. Karen and I, we were in a shop. And in the shop, there was a woman that had a radio playing in the background. And I always go to this shop whenever we're there. She's a nice lady. And so we were buying something there and there was something going on the radio. And I don't know if she laughed related to something or whatever, but I asked, what's being said on the radio? And she said, there's a teacher speaking on the radio, and he's talking about Elijah and the being fed by the Gentile or the widow woman there with the oil and with the remaining grain cake. It's interesting. I said, what's he saying about that? She said, what he's teaching is that you always ought to hold on to your faith and never be moved from your faith. Excuse me. That passage has nothing to do with that lesson. It has a lot of lessons, but that's not one of them. And so, but she's fascinated by this guy is the greatest teacher. It's so fascinating how he's able to add to the passage and give color to it, add things that aren't even found there in the passage. These are her words. My wife is my witness. I mean, she's not always, so I just fabricate all kinds of things, but she does happen to be on this. And all of this kind of stuff, absolutely fascinated by it. But that's the way that it worked, just playing fast and loose with the scriptures. And so here was this idea as it relates to healing. They said, well, you could stop a man if he was bleeding to death. You could apply a tourniquet and stop the bleeding. So he wouldn't die on the Sabbath day, but you'd stitch him up on the day after the Sabbath. Or if he broke a leg or broke an arm, you couldn't set it. You could get it in a place where it's kind of be restful and all, but you couldn't set it till the next day because that would constitute healing and laboring on the Sabbath day. Jesus ends up confronting them with the fact, and he said, which of you, you know, having an oxen or having a lamb, falls into a ditch? He speaks of it in Matthew's gospel. He said, which of you on a Sabbath day doesn't get it out? They all got their property out. Labor or no labor, sweat or no sweat, that I own that. That belongs to me, and it's in a ditch, and I don't want it to die, and I'm going to rescue it from the ditch. Sabbath day. They'd all do that. Jesus, in essence, says to them, you do that with your property on the Sabbath day. I am free to do with what is mine on the Sabbath day. And all of the world is his. And all of mankind is his and his creation to do with as he sees fit. And so here he is, this man is there, but it's all a setup. No compassion for him. But Jesus knew their thoughts, and he said to the man who had the withered hand, he said, arise and stand here. It's almost as if he's saying, in effect, listen, let's not pretend a game isn't being played here. Let's get you right out in the open. So we're not going to get, you know, false accusations made against me on the basis of something that was done quietly in some corner of the synagogue. Stand up, because what I'm going to do, I am willing to do openly. And so he stands up. And then Jesus said to these religious leaders, I'll ask you one thing. Is it lawful to do good or to do evil or to save life or to destroy it on the Sabbath day? And there's no answer. And he looked around at them all, and we know from Matthew's gospel that he looked in anger, and he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And then here are the four words that just so knocked me out. And he did so. And as he did so, his hand was restored as whole as the other. So Jesus is the Lord over the Sabbath day. He can heal on the Sabbath day if that's what he wants to do. One of the amazing things about this passage, it is one of the great devotional themes in my heart from the Scriptures. And that is behind every command that God gives in His Word, He couples with it the ability to obey that command. And as I obey the command, what is withered in my life heals without exception, without exception. I think there's a tendency to look at this man as he's standing there. And I mean, today, I mean, if Jesus did this even in some churches, you know, that here's this man and he's crippled, you know, and he's got this withered hand, and Jesus just comes up and he says, you know, stretch out your hand. And don't you think that if he could stretch out his hand, he would have stretched out his hand by now? And what kind of cruel one is this, you know, and just to give a command like that and all. And so often, even today, and I'll tell you, it's for people that are staying with the Word of God, people that have a confidence in the Word of God, that God stands behind His Word. He never gives it independent of Himself. And you see these kind of attitudes that are put towards people that believe the Bible and that God is behind the Bible, and they say, yes, we know about that church. Yes, we know about that preacher. And he's just got this simplistic things that he tells people to do right from the Bible like he believes it. But God stands behind His Word. And when that man is standing there, his eyes are fixed on Jesus. Jesus said, I say to you. And then as his eyes are fixed upon Him, then he extends and then his hand able to do it. And then the withered area of his life is healed. And I don't care what withered area I have in my life to this day as I obey God's Word. I find I have the ability to obey it, and then the withered areas of my life become healed. Well, the reaction of the religious leaders was that they were filled with rage, and they discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. Again, no mercy in their lives. And it came to pass in those days that Jesus went out to a mountain to pray, and he continued all night in prayer to God. So Luke's emphasis upon the prayer life of Jesus once again. And when it was day, he called his disciples to him, and from this larger group of disciples, he chose 12, whom he named apostles. Simon, whom he also named Peter, Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, Simon called the Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And so he chooses these 12 after a night in prayer. I love what Gail Irwin says. He says, the only thing that makes me wonder about God is His choice of me. Isn't the truth? After a night of prayer, he takes and he chooses these 12. And what an odd lot he chooses, mixed together, puts them together. He's quite a risk taker, even to this day. And he came down with them, and he stood on a level place. And those are key words to recognize, on a level place. because the sermon that he's going to give now, though it has a resemblance to the Sermon on the Mount, it's not given on a mount, it's given on a level place. This is known as the Sermon on the Plain. So he stood on a level place with a crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and from the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases, as well as those who were tormented with unclean spirits, and they were healed, and the whole multitude sought to touch him, for power went out from him, and he healed them all. So here you have the circumstances of the Sermon on the Plain. Jesus is with his disciples. He has chosen the apostles. It is in front of them a sea of human need in the world. And so he's going to do what? He's going to teach his disciples what they need to know in order that they might be effective for his purposes in the midst of those needs, just as we are living in a sea of need on planet Earth. And so he speaks to us from this same sermon. And Jesus lifted his eyes toward his disciples. Now notice, they're already disciples. They're already followers of Jesus. He isn't going to give them now a way that if they keep all of these rules, that they can earn their way into heaven. They're already disciples. And what he's telling them now is, you are members of a different kind of kingdom than the kingdom of this world, and this is what I want my citizens of my kingdom to look like. And so he begins, as he did with the Sermon on the Mount, with some blessings or beatitudes. And he said, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." Now notice he doesn't say, "Blessed are the poor." There's no particular blessing to being poor. I think it was Rockefeller who said, "I've been rich and I've been poor. Rich is better. Rich is better." But he says, "Blessed are you poor." He's talking to his disciples. And he's talking about his disciples who choose to follow him and obey his call upon their life, even if it means poverty for them in this life. They have the ability, perhaps the talents, to earn a great fortune for themselves, apart from God's call upon their life. But they choose to become poor in order to fulfill the specific call that God may have upon their life. And God's people make that choice all over the world tonight. What does he put their focus on? Not their poverty here in this earth. Yours is the kingdom of heaven. He reminds them of what's waiting for them, what's ahead for them, the blessings that are ahead for them on the other side of glory when I get home, because this is not my home. He said, "Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be filled." Again, he's talking to the disciples. Disciples that choose to follow God's call upon the uniqueness of their life to serve him in places in this world where, in order to do that, it's going to mean experiencing hunger as a part of my daily reality. And he says to them, "For you shall be filled." It'll be rewarded in a future day. There's a marriage supper of the Lamb coming. Every kind of pizza you can imagine is going to be there. No Coke, only Pepsi. "Blessed are you," he says, "who weep now, for you shall laugh." To live for the Lord in this world is going to mean weeping. We can't disengage from this world the way that others do. There's a price to be paid for opened eyes. There's a glory about having eyes opened, to have his eyes, to see the world the way that he does, to see individual human beings the way that he does, to begin to understand pain that individual people are experiencing in different situations in a way that we never would apart from him, but we do because of his Holy Spirit within us. And there's a sorrow to walking with the Lord in this world. It's a sorrowful thing to watch people waste their lives to destroy their lives, to see it be so needless, to watch children be robbed of their innocence for a buck in the United States of America, to see everything upside down. There's a sorrow to it. But he says, blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. One day all of those tears are going to be turned into joy. And then he said, blessed are you, not if, but when men hate you. I really like people hating me. No, I don't. I like people to like me as much as the next person. It's not fun to be hated in this world. But they will, and it means to be hated because of our love for the Lord and our faithfulness to the Lord. And when they exclude you, isn't it fun to be excluded as a Christian? And revile you and cast out your name as evil. It's a terrible thing. For the Son of Man's sake, he said, rejoice in that day and leap for joy. If you haven't leapt for joy in a while, that situation, for indeed your reward is great in heaven, for in the like manner their fathers did to the prophets. And so he speaks of this fact that we're going to be excluded, we're going to be hated, we're going to be reviled, our name is going to be cast out as evil because of our commitment to the Lord. But he says, your reward will be great in heaven. Always that eternal focus. You know, sometimes when a person is in the middle of a difficult thing, even in secular counseling, what will they do? They'll sit the person down and they'll say, listen, this isn't going to go on forever in your life. There's going to be a next year. There's going to be a 5 years from now. There's going to be a 10 years from now. What's the person trying to do? He's trying to add some perspective. The person's lost in the moment. And what the Lord does here is he takes difficult circumstances that we can find ourselves in this world, and he gives the ultimate perspective to it. In other words, it's not always going to be like this. One day you'll be in glory, and while you are being persecuted, realize that you're in very good company. They've done this to my people all through the ages. And then in verse 24, the Sermon on the Plain is different from the Sermon on the Mount, because this sermon contains woes. Now remember, some people look and they say, well, the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain are really the same thing and all. It's not unusual that Jesus would repeat his teachings in different places, say some of it in the Sermon on the Mount in that context, and then say something else and couple other things to it in another place. They didn't tape all the sermons in those days. It's about half of them. It's a reel-to-reel thing they were doing back in those days. Well, there's nothing being taped in those days. So it was necessary in order for a message to get out across a broad group of people for repetition. I remember reading concerning G. Campbell Morgan, one of the great preachers of this last century. And he taught not only in England at the Westminster Chapel, but he was a conference speaker all over the world. One time he opened up one of his messages and he declared, this morning I'm going to preach to you a message that I'm preaching for the 103rd time. And I think that's one of the reasons that he never allowed his sermons to be taped. There's only one taped sermon in existence, because he didn't want to teach it in one place and have it go all around the world. He wanted to go places and teach it for himself. And so here is Jesus. There's some repetition of things, but then he brings in other things. And in this sermon, he names not only the four blessings, but also four woes. But woe to you, again to the disciples, who are rich. And this is the idea of those who are rich, and they have become rich at the expense of God's call upon their life. God wanted them to do something with their life. God had a different plan for their life. They chose riches as the way to spend their life. And so he said, woe to you who are rich with that kind of an idea, for you have received your consolation. Enjoy the riches today. It comes at the expense of reward later. You'll be the one wearing a beanie in heaven. And then he says, woe to you who are full. And the idea here is to disciples that choose to live a self-indulgent life, again at the expense of God's call upon their life. And he said, for you shall hunger. They'll hunger when eternal rewards are given out. And then, woe to you who laugh now. In other words, they make pleasure and laughter the great focus of their life in this life. Even as a disciple, Jesus said, for you shall mourn and you shall weep. There'll be a day of regret in their future because instead of spending their life the way that God wanted them to spend it, they spend it on pleasure and laughter as the master passion of their life. I have talked with people near the end of their lives. They're very near death and they have lived the entirety of their Christian lives for pleasure and for laughter. And believe me, there is regret. There is a longing for another 20 years to do it entirely different from the way that they have done it. And so there is regret with it, and there is mourning and weeping. And woe to you when all men speak well of you. I don't want all men to speak well of me. I don't want the wicked to speak well of me. For so did their fathers to the false prophets. And so there are some disciples, they live for the praise of man, and they don't realize that you want that praise, but they praise the wicked as well as you, and if they praise the wicked as well as you, then what is their praise good for? What does it mean in our lives? It's a way to waste a life, and there's a woe pronounced upon it. But Jesus said, I say to you who hear, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. And so Jesus now begins to lay out some characteristics in our life that will differentiate us from the rest of the world. And most of these characteristics he lays out, they center on this theme of love. He said, I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Now, nobody can do that in their own strength. That takes being born again into another kingdom and receiving God's strength. I'm very good at hating people who hate me. It's a gift, really. It's just fabulous. But this is a different thing entirely. Bless those who curse you and pray for those who spitefully use you. Now, this is rough stuff, isn't it? But a person who lives like this stands out like crazy in this world. And that's the idea. To him who strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. And from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. In other words, somebody has a genuine need, freely give to them. Give to anyone, everyone who asks of you, and from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back. And just as you want men to do to you, you also to do to them likewise. Verse 31, known as the Golden Rule. Now, the interesting thing about Jesus' take on the Golden Rule is that this rule existed from the negative angle before he spoke this. And what the teachers had been saying prior was, don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. But you can spend your whole life not doing anything under that. Jesus says, not only do I not want you doing to others what you don't want done to you, but we're going to move into the realm that's proactive in this life. I want you to do to people what you want to have done to you. That's something that's infinitely superior. He says, but if you love those who love you, in other words, this love that is he's spoken about, this is what will make us different from the rest of the world. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? That doesn't require any supernatural life. For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. Anybody can live that kind of life. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. But love your enemies. Do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. And your reward will be great. And then here's the key. And you'll be sons of the highest. In other words, we will be revealed to be a chip off the old block because in being this way, we're being like him. For he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore, be merciful just as your Father also is merciful. He said, judge not, and you will not be judged. So we're not to judge other people. Doesn't mean that we don't, it means that we don't judge their motives. We don't judge their heart. I'm not free to do that. I am free to judge a person's life, their actions, their words. He's going to talk about coming to a conclusion about what a tree is on the basis of its fruit. Well, that takes judgment. But I'm not free to judge people's motives or their hearts, things that I can't know, that only God knows. But I have found, as I mentioned before, I have found that when I judge people, I am invariably wrong about 99% of the time. Again, this is a tremendous gift that I have. Not everyone has it. But he says, not only am I commanded not to judge, but there's a blessing with it, and you won't be judged. A person that's a judger, they end up being judged, don't they, by other people. And when you don't judge other people, then you find that they're non-judgmental towards you. And then he says, condemn not, and you will not be condemned. A person who thinks the best about other people, doesn't condemn other people, gives them a second chance. That kind of person finds that when they're in need of the benefit of the doubt, that people are eager to give it to them. There's a blessing in that. He said, forgive and you'll be forgiven. A forgiving person, very quickly in the day in which they need forgiveness, and the day comes in which we all need forgiveness from other people, people are quicker to give us that forgiveness. He said, give and it'll be given to you. So you give to people. We're known as a generous person. All of a sudden, the word becomes known that I'm in a terrible strait. I have this kind of need, and this accident has happened, and this is where the family is and all. All of a sudden, what happens? People come out and they give. And so he said, give and it'll be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, it will be given into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it'll be measured back to you. And that's a law of life. And then he spoke a parable to them, and he said, can the blind lead the blind? Not very well. Will they not both fall into the ditch? And what he's heading into now as it relates to a theme is that in order for me to be helpful in another person's life, I need to be different than them. I can't be dominated if I'm going to help a person who is dominated by a sin in their life. I can't help them if I am dominated by that same sin, or even more dominated by that same sin. There needs to be a difference between my life and other people's lives in order for me to be a help to them. Otherwise, if we're all blind, we're all going to end up in the ditch. Somebody has to see. And the Christian has to be the one that sees. He said, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. And so the teacher needs to know more than the disciple. He needs to be ahead of the disciple in order to be a help to the disciple. He said, and why do you look at a speck in your brother's eye, a wooden speck, and you don't perceive the plank, that is the 4x4 in your own eye? And the interesting thing about a speck, a wooden speck and a plank, is that they're the same material. You're just talking about a small amount of one and a very large amount of another. So he gives the whole situation absurdity here, to make the point. He said, how can you say to your brother, brother, let me remove that speck that's in your eye, when you don't see, you got a 4x4 in your own eye? He said, hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. And so you don't want your eye doctor to come into the room with big planks coming out of his eye, or you don't want him, feeling his way toward, laser surgery today, doc? Is that what we've got going on here, He's got to be in better shape than you in order to help you. And so here is a situation where, and is so often the case, a guy thinks, I can help this guy because I really know this sin, or I really know this situation. I've got a huge plank in my eye, but I won't be able to help anyone. You'll just wedge that speck deeper into their eye. So what he's saying here is that we have to be further along than the people that we're helping. And of course, we can be that by the Spirit of God. And so the necessity For he says, for a good tree does not bear bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. A good tree bears good fruit. A bad tree bears bad fruit. You know a tree, every tree is known by its own fruit. For men do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they gather grapes from a bramble bush. And so you know a tree, when you look at a tree and you see an orange, you just stop and you go, don't tell me. Kumquat. This is a kumquat tree. And you see an orange, you know you got an orange tree. I mean, if it looks like a duck, and it walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, you got a duck on your hands. And one of the most important things as a Christian, and there's nothing wrong with it, fruit is everything. Fruit's what you trust, not words, not good intentions. What's the fruit? That tells me what the tree is. Everything else is secondary. And a good man, he likens all of this to a tree. You don't have grapes coming from a bramble bush, and you don't have thorns coming from a grape, you know, from a fig tree and all. Whatever's coming out of the tree, that's what the tree is. And a good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good. A good man has good fruit coming out of his life. And an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil. You can't look and say, look at all that evil coming out of his life, but he's a good man. No. You can't look at a man and say, look at all that good that's coming out of his life, but he's an evil man. No. You know a tree by its fruit. For out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. And I've always liked that passage. You ever want to take your spiritual temperature? Just put a little tape recorder right here in your pocket for a day and just listen to what you say. So sometimes people say, oh boy, you know, I've really got a mouth problem. Oh no, I've got a heart problem. What comes out of my mouth comes out of the heart. I need a cleansing of my heart. So out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. And then Jesus closes in the same way that he closed the Sermon on the Mount. And he said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do the things which I say? The inconsistency of calling him Lord without obeying him. He said, whoever comes to me and hears, and that's a key word, hears my sayings, and then circle the next word, does them. Hears and does. There's a certain thing that happens in that kind of a life. A man or a woman who hears, but doesn't just hear, they hear and they do. He says, I'll show you whom he's like. He's like a man building a house who dug deep and he laid the foundation on the rock. And when the flood rose and the stream beat vehemently against the house and could not shake it, for it was founded on the rock. How do I found my life upon a rock? Something that's unshakable in this world, in the midst of the storms of this world. Well, that's what I'm going to tackle next week. It'll be a 170-part series. Now, it's not that complicated. This kind of life is one that hears God's word and then obeys it. And the person that hears his word and obeys his word is the one who can rightfully call him Lord. There's a certain quality of life that comes out of simply hearing him and obeying him. But he said, he who heard and did nothing with what they heard is like a man who built a house. Everybody's building a house in this thing, aren't they? Just like in life, everyone's building a house. But he built a house on the earth, on the sand, without a foundation, and against which the streams beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. And obedience is critical. And it is revealed by life's storms. Well, I'm going to stop there tonight. We won't go into chapter 7. Because there's a lot in there. And I went a little long this morning, so I don't want to provoke you to wrath. Can I tell you, sir, it was the Lord's will. You stop it. Last night I went to bed. As I do most nights. And I had the goofiest dream. This is not spiritual. Close your Bibles. Put your notes away. That old. And I had this goofy dream. And what the dream was, is there I am, and I'm in this pulpit. And the room is just a scattering of people left in it. And what has happened is all of a sudden, there I am. I'm in the pulpit in the dream. I am in the thing. I'm not watching it from a distance. I'm in the thing. These poor people through, you know. And then this morning. I'm just kidding. I tell you, we all, listen, thorns take a variety of, you know, differences, but that was weird. That was a weird dream, you know. You fall asleep and just keep talking, and then you wake up and you go, I don't know, what in the world have I said all of that time? Well, we'll leave it there for tonight.